Hey, everybody, this is Pierre Quinn, and you're listening to the Leading While Green podcast, where my mission is to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. On this episode of the podcast, episode number 41, I'm featuring my conversation with Ron Carucci. Ron is the author of Rising to Power. He's been a TEDx speaker and a consultant to leaders across the country. His research is into why leaders fail, and he gives insights on what emerging leaders can do to prevent those failures. This is a rich conversation, so I need you to listen up. Before we jump into the conversation with Ron Carucci, I just want to thank everybody who's been supporting this podcast. Thank all of you who have left 5-star reviews and comments on iTunes, all of you who have shared this, all of you who have featured it on your social media, on your platforms, all of you who've sent a text message or email to let people know that I have a podcast and the new episodes are out. I really appreciate you being a part of this tribe, being a part of this movement, and going on this journey with me. And I want to encourage you to just keep going. Just keep going. Keep sharing. If you haven't done it, stop right now. I need you to stop right now. Hit pause on this. Head over to iTunes. Leave a 5-star review. Leave some comments so other people can know about this journey of effective leadership that we are on and our mission to take this message of good leadership around the world. So my conversation with Ron Carucci, I really need you to listen up. He's going to drop some insights on us that all leaders need to pay attention to. So now here's my featured conversation with Ron Carucci. Hey, everybody, this is Pierre Quinn, and you're listening to the Leading While Green podcast. My guest on today's podcast is Ron Carucci. Ron is the co-founder and managing partner at Navalent. He's worked with CEOs and executives who are pursuing transformational change for their organizations, for their leaders, and for their industries. He's got a 30-year track record helping some of the world's most influential executives tackle challenges of strategy, organization, and leadership. Startups to Fortune 10s, turnarounds, new markets and strategies, overhauling leadership, culture, and redesigning for growth. He's worked in more than 25 countries, 4 continents. He's written 8 books, including his most recent number one, Amazon, Rising to Power. He writes in all of the right spaces, contributor to Harvard Business Review, Forbes, Fortune Magazine, CEO Magazine, Business Insider, MSNBC, Business Week, Smart Business, and Thought Leaders. In his 10-year longitudinal study, including interviews with more than 2,700 people, he uncovered 4 recurring patterns that set the most influential leaders apart. Ron, thanks for joining us today on the Leading While Green podcast.
Pierre, it's such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So give us, as we dive in, just give us a little bit about your background. Where are you from, and how did you get on this path to helping leaders and influential people make a bigger difference in the world?
Yeah. Well, so I'm originally from New York, born and raised, proud, brash New Yorker, and began my career in a very different field. Began my career in the arts, and quickly learned that I bore easily. And so while I was getting all these great jobs in New York City while I was in school there studying in the arts, and everybody be like, wow, what a great job. And I'd be thinking, I have to do the same thing 8 times a week for how long? And so I took a break from New York. I went on the road because at least in repertory work, you get much more variety. And I went to Europe. I lived in Europe for 3 years. And we had contracts with the State Department and military to do training. And so at least it was a much different application of some of the media kinds of things we were doing and the artistic work we were doing. I was at Dachau, in the chapel of all places at Dachau, doing a workshop. Back then, the term wasn't diversity and inclusion, but if there had been a term called diversity and inclusion, that's what the topic would have been. But it was dealing with differences. The curtain had not fallen yet, but it was close. And so we had East Germans and West Germans. We had military-based State Department. We had Americans, civilians, military. We had Germans, West Germans, a mix of people who were suddenly finding themselves needing to collaborate in ways they had never before and struggling to do it. And during the middle of our content, one young soldier stood up and said, "I'm just so tired of being trained to hate." And it was very moving. There was a little across the room, but the first thing in my thought was, how did something I did up here make him think that? But I wanted to know more, and so we processed a little bit as a group. But then afterwards, it's Munich, so you go out to beer. That's what you do. So we went out for a drink, and I wanted to hear more. He wasn't much older than I was at the time, and I wanted to hear more of his story. And I think that was the place in my career. I don't know that I understood it at the time, but where I realized, telling great stories is very interesting, but engaging other people to help them understand their own story, that's really life-giving for me. That I could never get bored doing that. And I think that was the pivot for me into behavioral sciences and the work I do today. It was a little bit of a long, multi-year pivot. And that was about 30-something years ago.
Wow. Okay. So you have this experience in a foreign country and coming to realize that there's something that speaks to you, helping people process their story and their journey. Now, how do you leverage that, or how do you journey in that to get to a place where when we read your bio, and you know how the bio thing goes, we read somebody's bio and we're kind of thrown back in our chair. And we say, maybe as a young leader or a young entrepreneur, man, I could never get there, or I would like to be there one day. What's the story behind the bio that gets you to the place? You have your own consulting company, you're writing every space, you're a TEDx speaker. How do we get there?
I look at the bio and I think, well, I'd like to be there one day too. it's a lot of years in there, right?
Okay.
But practically speaking, I went and got trained in behavioral sciences. I got a master's in work behavior. I took a job inside organizations. So I began my career doing leadership work inside organizations. And after 10 years, and I used to collect up these things. My kids loved this collection because it meant more time with me. I collected severance packages, which was code for inside, Jesus said you can't be a prophet in your own land, and turns out he was right. And so I'd go inside these big companies as part of their teams, and I assumed they actually wanted me to tell the truth. And I assumed that talking about the things. Now I probably didn't have all the skill to do it either, but I found out that what got me in trouble inside organizations got me paid well outside organizations, and I realized, you know what? If you're going to be a prophetic voice, you probably should do it as an outsider, not an insider. And I realized consulting was probably a better fit for me than being on an internal OD army or even leading an internal OD army. Mm-hmm. And after several attempts, I realized, you know what, I need to take the hint here, stay outside. And I worked at this wonderful consulting firm, really, really premier firm in New York City for 8 years. And it was a wonderful experience. And then it got sold to one of the giant machines.
Okay.
And several of us thought, we love this work too much. We love stepping into the mess of systems and leaders and organizations and communities. And now it's about feeding the dinosaur. And that's not fun anymore. But we can go do this on our own. So 14 years ago, we left the firm and started Navalent. I don't think any of us thought about we're starting a firm. That's just kind of where it went. But because to do the kinds of transformational work we needed more people. But the reality was we loved this work. We loved doing it together. And that wasn't going to be able to happen in this newly acquired space anymore. So we left there in 2003-04. It was at the same time I was moving to Seattle anyway, to come out here. So that's kind of how it worked out. I could have been a lot more intentional about it than the bio would suggest that I was. All of our career stories sound wonderful in retrospect, don't they?
Absolutely. 200 never, words, right?
Never on the way there do they look anything but crazy. But about 3 years ago, I was struggling. I felt like, at this place in my career, why am I still attracting sociopaths for clients? why am I not being able to attract higher quality people and human beings and good-hearted people that I want to work with as much as I would like? Well, part of it was there's about 27 million people entering this field every day now. When we began the firm, it wasn't that crowded a space. Mm-hmm. People in the org behavioral science world were there, but now, you know, there are leadership coaches or development coach consultants, small boutique firms in the thousands.
Yeah.
And to the naked consumer, we all look the same. It doesn't, you know, your experience level doesn't, they don't know what they're buying. So everybody uses the same language. And so how can you tell people apart? And so I thought, well, I'm getting drowned in the mix of a lot of people who aren't qualified to be doing this work. And how do I help myself stand apart? So I hired a coach. So I thought I have to take my own medicine here. I need to know what it's like to be on the other side of me and get diagnosed and given feedback and get a development plan. And it was thrilling and terrifying and agonizing all in the same mix, but best decision I ever made professionally, at least in the last few years. And we've been working together for 3 years now.
Okay.
And so much of what's in that bio is because of her. You know, one of her many opening diagnostics, she came back with her assessment. She said, you know, if your goal was to be the best kept secret in consulting, you've really overachieved.
Wow.
Because you spend all of your time, and she did this network analytics and a digital footprint look at me. And she said, you spend all of your time talking to people who already know you, but you're never going to be able to set yourself apart from everybody else if you don't talk to people who don't know you. And I'm like, okay, what does that mean? She said, well, like, why aren't you writing for, you have great content, why aren't you writing for Forbes or HBR or Inc. or Fast Company? I said, okay, but I'm sure if I call them up and say, hey, I want to write for you, they're not going to say, sure. She goes, no, but I'll introduce you to the editors. Would you like that? I'm like, oh, that's how this works.
Okay.
And then we began a series of, and, you know, she was so brilliant. If you go on LinkedIn, I've wrote a whole essay on the challenges of being a thought leader are different than you think. I mean, you put it in your show notes. And it's my own personal, all the struggles, all the anxieties, all the difficulties of my own learning curve at this point in my career to be so experienced and yet still so novice when it came to stewarding my own voice. And it's about my relationship with her and what we learned together. But she was very crafty in how she, you know, layered on each new level of work and not telling me the whole picture, because I would have never hired her. I would have said, you're nuts. It's never going to happen. You're going to be writing, you're going to write 150 articles. You need to probably, I'm like, it's never going to happen. So I wouldn't have believed her. So she was smart not to tell me. But so much of the trajectory you're reading about really happened in the last 3 or 4 years with a lot of concerted effort.
Well, okay. So you unloaded a lot on us, and I'm trying to not unpack it all, but there's so much in there. Let's come from the perspective of sitting in the seat now and having someone critique you, having someone reinforce for you that you need to network, that you need to reach out. You have all this experience, but now you need to be coached. And I think especially for my emerging leaders and some of my recent college grads who are trying to step into the field of work, why is that element of being a professional so important, of sitting in the seat now and having someone talk to you?
You know, it's so painful. My daughter just graduated from college, and she's now in the process of trying to get a job, and it's painful, right? Because, you know, she's like, that's a job I want to apply for that. And I'm like, sweetheart, that's not how it works. And I'm trying to teach her about, well, have you checked your LinkedIn profile to see if you know anybody? Mm-hmm. Or I know people who worked at that company before here. And I think much like we talked about earlier, where seminary grads are coming out so ill-prepared, you know, so many college grads don't know what the real world really means and why relationships and networks are important and why you got to get yourself out there and known. Even if thought leadership isn't your end goal or being a solopreneur or isn't, regardless of what your aim is, you've got to have a network of connections of people who are advocates and support you. And there's plenty of great material out there now. Networking doesn't have to mean the cheesy business card exchange, feel like you're a stalker, feel like you're, you know, there to sort of take from people and make people going to think you're a, you know, creepy person. It doesn't have to be that anymore. There are still ways to build authentic relationships and genuine connections with other people of mutual benefit. And there's a whole new wave now of intellectual capital coming out now on how we have to rethink networking and how we have misconceptions about it. Or I don't have a network. I'm like, you let's start listing the people you think you don't know. You'd be shocked at how many people who know you and who would support you if you asked for help, they'd give it to you. But most people just don't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. And so it's just part of the deal. It's a crowded world of work. It's an idea economy. Mm-hmm. It's no longer a make stuff economy. And so the prescience of your ideas, the credibility of your ability to articulate those ideas and embody them is a huge criteria on which people are going to hire you. Your evident emotional intelligence, your ability to connect with other human beings, and your ability to articulate yourself in a fairly coherent way, even at 22, is important. And you have to practice that stuff, right? It doesn't come easy for most of us. I'm working with a guy in his early 40s, was president of a company, but he's never had to look for a job. He grew up in this environment, was hired by the venture capitalists, and now he's in his early 40s, and he's never had to sell himself. He's never had to get out there, and he's built a great brand, and he's very talented. Mm-hmm. But his ability to represent his talent, his ability to tell the story of his talent, is a different set of muscles, and he's never had to build it. And so there's this very imbalanced set of people within him, right? There's him, and then there's the version of him he's trying to tell people about, and is voted to do that. And they're imbalanced. And so building your ability to sometimes it feels, pardon the word, but like prostitutional. It feels like I'm selling myself. Mm-hmm. And no one likes that. It feels horrible. And yet, how do you be self-promotional without all the crud that comes with feeling self-promotional? It can be done. It is a thing, and people expect that of you. And what if I'm an introvert, and what if I'm not articulate? And there's all kinds of what ifs, but you work around those. But it is such an important thing early on as a leader. If you have aspirations to climb to broader positions in an organization, or if you have aspirations to start something of your own, or aspirations to influence the world as a solopreneur with your ideas, mm-hmm. there are proven ways to construct that pathway. It's not, we often think, well, look, she just took a few pictures on Instagram and now she's making 20 grand a month. Or he started his podcast and now he's bringing in $200,000 a month in ad revenue. Well, that's not really how it happened. And so, it takes 10 years to be an overnight success, right?
Right, so, yeah.
And so I think many people underestimate the value of or the importance of all that upfront basic layering of capabilities.
I think that this is a good segue into why leaders maybe who have tons of potential, a good track record, but then they ascend to a certain position and then the failure rate kind of increases. Now, how does that play, and how does that, the relationship element, the networking element, the preparedness element, play into the part of your research that suggests that within the first 18 months, half of the leaders that transition to seats of influence are failing, calling for help?
I wish more would call for help sooner. You heard the story that research began with a phone call I got from a young, very promising leader who had taken on a bigger position after one of our transformational efforts. And by all accounts, this kid was going to go the distance. Smart, sharp, talented, disciplined, so likable, deeply credible, authentic, and a lot of integrity. It was everything you wanted in an emerging leader. And when he called me 9 months into his assignment telling me he'd been fired, it was like a, what? And then his CEO called me a couple hours later saying, hey, we had to let him go. And then inferred, well, it's kind of your fault because you were supposed to go coach him and get him ready and you didn't. And that was like a wrecking ball hitting me in the head, because that's the last thing anybody ever wants to hear, is that you contributed to somebody's demise. So I said, can we come investigate? I need to understand what happened here. How we could not have misjudged him that badly. How could he go from being this promising rising star to being a complete dodo mm-hmm. in 9 months? That can't be the story we tell here. That's not what happened. And so that investigation is what led to our 10-year study to find out, why is it that we have so readily accepted this failure rate? And it's, Pierre, it's a wonder any of them are succeeding. Hmm. When you look at the landmines communities and organizations put in their way, when you see what obstacles they are not even prepared for are there, that you wonder any of them can rise above all that and succeed. A lot of it's preparation work, But a lot of it's over preparation. So for example, we ask people in interviews, we say to them, look, and you know, what's the least reliable device we know we shouldn't use for selection? The resume. What's the device we're using most for selection? The resume. And we'll look at it and we'll say things like, oh my gosh, look at this great, all these great departments you've led. That's what we need here in our sales department. Or, wow, you built all these great brands. That's what we need. Or, wow, you built four apps before. We need apps. And we look at this track record and the message we send them is this. You have a formula. You have this recipe. We'd like you to bring that recipe here. And in that, we've said you can ignore context. We just want you to come rinse and repeat what you've already done. So I now think I've got a mandate. So I show up to this role feeling like I'm being watched, feeling like I've got to reproduce this success. So I reach back and I, rather than reaching for wisdom, I reach for a recipe. And I start applying the recipe to this in context. Well, of course, inevitably, it doesn't work, right? The community, the organization resists. I slap it harder. And then I get frustrated and I go to the hiring manager and tell me, you didn't tell me it was this bad. Or how have you made any money? Or how has this worked this way for so long? Now my diagnosis has become an indictment. And everybody knows that and they feel judged by me. So what do they begin to do? Back away. And now I don't even realize I'm being isolated. And in my opening move of taking this mythical mate, this mythical bait of a mandate, letting my diagnosis become an indictment. Then the halo effect that I had when I came in, now the halo becomes a noose. And they're going to hang me with it. And I don't even know what's happening. That, and that's just a few of them here. We found several dozen of those kinds of landmines in the way, baked into the very processes we use to appoint leaders and identify them for opportunities. And there were dozens more. And those are the things people have to sidestep around in order to rise up, stick the landing, and thrive in broader positions of leadership. Then there's the things it takes to be successful. But you might not even get to demonstrate those if you can't get past all the landmines that are in the way in the process of just getting the job.
What's the pushback been like in organizations that you work with? Maybe some with high turnover rate in executive positions, and you say, okay, here's how I see it. Something's wrong with our process. Something's wrong with how we transition people to leadership, how we do talent acquisition. Like, our system and culture is wrong. What's the pushback? What's the pushback been like?
People are like, yes, we agree.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. But now we have to change it. Oh, they're not going to let me do that. Oh, can't we start with something small, right? Then the crisis of courage comes in. Nobody disagrees. We were shocked at the response to the research. We had never expected, you know, when HBR published it, to be named one of the ideas that mattered most in 2016. We were shocked at the response. People recognized the four attributes we set aside. It was like this resonant, yes, I see that. I want to become that. But when it comes time to the process of, okay, we just need to start about 10 years sooner than you think we do. Oh.
Wow.
Well, you mean like, so 6 months before they become vice presidents, too late?
This is good.
And so would you think these people all just be, they're not an accident. They actually became those things. But if you look back, maybe it was in spite of you, but if you look back at the experiences they had since the day they entered the workforce, or the day they first became a first-line supervisor, or the first time they led people, they began having experiences to build these four muscles. So when they got to their first job, they had their 10,000 hours of leadership work and these four capabilities that set them apart. And so, sure, it was still a learning curve. And yeah, there was some wobbly moments at that level of an altitude, but they were ready. But when you uncover these major deficits in people's ability to connect or see broader parts of the organization or to contextualize, at the moment you give them their first senior director job or vice president job, and then what's the term we've all heard, Pierre? Well, they weren't a good fit. Really? Why were they a good fit when you gave them the job? But no one ever says it was my judgment that was flawed about their fit. Right? It was them that wasn't a good fit. Well, who decided they were a fit in the first place? You. But so the challenge becomes to your question about the pushback is people are not self-assessing. Could we have contributed to this problem? Did we say, no, it's just, you know, some mysterious force. I'm like, well, you think that people are assuming that 50-50 odds must mean it must, like, it's like the casino. Hope this one sticks. And it's just become so normal that half don't work that we don't even give it a thought that maybe we're part of the problem and part of how we're shepherding people's careers and what we're doing to prepare them. And so we have all these great terms, don't we? Well, this will be a stretch assignment. Well, what's that code for? Let me get rid of this. What's that code for? It's code for, you know, they're not ready.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or it's going to be a skip level job. Well, so now we're just institutionalizing with terms the fact that we're setting people up to fail. we're going to give you a skip level. Oh, yeah. And I always, when people, either HR leaves the room, I'm like, do you know what they just told you? That you heard that this is an honor. That this may not be an honor. Mm-hmm. This may be a suicide mission. And, you know, then I get the call 4 months in. What did I get myself into? What was I thinking? And that may happen under the best of conditions, right? Because people always have buyer's remorse when they start something that's harder than they thought. I can get you through that. But if everything is stacked against you, that's a different mission. And it really was a staggering set of discoveries, Pierre, to find out that, and these are not the idiots. They're not like just jerks. These are great people with incredible hearts and minds and brilliant ideas and ambitions and a lot of optimism and hope that can have great impact. And I've never had a CEO, we worked a lot, you know, a senior executive or CEO that I work with say to me, you know, gosh, we got too many darn good leaders. We need to prune this back. That's not what I'm hearing. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing we don't have enough good leaders. You know, for a long time, it was there's a shortage of leaders. And when I wrote my 2006 book, Leadership Divided, about emerging leaders, that's, mm-hmm. you know, you go pick that up. It's for your audience. I thought I want to go bust this myth because what do you mean we have too many, not enough leaders? There's plenty of leaders. And CEOs telling me, I see plenty of leaders out there. They don't look like me. They have tattoos and piercings in places I didn't know you could pierce, and they talk a little differently. But there's plenty of good ideas and enthusiasm and commitment to the company out there. We're just not looking for it the right way. And sure enough, you know, you had this. That was when I wrote Leadership Divided. Millennials were just making their appearance on the scene. I don't think we even call them millennials yet. But you had this, and I think it's still an issue today for your audience. You have this war between legacy and potential.
Yeah. Right? You know, absolutely.
Between emerging and incumbent leaders. I think the whole demographic label of millennials and boomers, and I think it's crap. I think we need to stop using those labels. They do nothing to define the truth. These people are far more similar than they are different. I wrote this article a bunch of months ago that opened up with entitled, overambitious, lazy, blah, 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 blah. And I said, sounds like all the words we'd use to describe millennials, right? Yeah, those same words opened up a 1969 Life magazine article about boomers. So we're not that different. The difference is that the millennials have more options than the boomers had or the Xers had, right? They can go create their own options, and they're willing to do that. But the reality is they want very much the same things. Yes, they are a deeply social justice-minded generation, more so than others. Because you know why? We told them to be. Yeah. We told them you can change the world. You can be anything you want. You can make a big difference. And turns out they believed us. Now we have to get out of their way and help them do it. Stop saying, sit down, shut up, wait your turn. But so you have these millennials who feel like their potential is threatened by the legacy, wanting to be left by the Xers and boomers. And they feel like their legacy is threatened by the potential of these millennials, especially when the relationships get reversed and the millennials are the bosses, right? Mm-hmm. We need to step back and rethink that. Your legacy is nothing outside my potential.
Yes, absolutely.
My potential will never get realized if you don't make it your legacy. So we need each other to meet. These are not competitive forces the way we're behaving. These are actually highly compatible forces that we can achieve mutual satisfaction with if we work at it. But we've got the equation wrong. We think it's more important to talk about how do you deal with those millennials. You know what? That's the wrong question. So anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying the preparation work is so important so early on to begin that pathway of ascent.
It reminds me of a business cartoon that says something to the effect of, what if we train our people well? It's two guys are talking, I guess, executives. What if we train our people well and they leave? And the other guy says, what if we don't and they stay?
Yeah.
And you feel that tension.
I tell people all the time when they're worried about retention risks, I say, your biggest fear is not that they quit and leave. Your biggest fear should be that they quit and stay.
Listen, I know people are going to have to replay this a couple of times because you're dropping so many nuggets of information and insights. Before time gets too far away from us, we've explained, kind of surveyed the landscape. We recognize that there's a problem. We recognize there's challenges just in how we train leaders and succession planning and how we get them up to the seat. But what are some solutions? How can we resolve some of this? And what are some of the secrets that the people who make a big difference and have significant influence have and implement that the rest of us are not doing?
The great news is that, as you mentioned earlier in the introduction, there are four. We cut this data up 99 times, literally 99 regression analyses we did, because I didn't want to have to. The issue was that the people that set themselves apart were good at all four of them. They weren't. Three out of four didn't count. You got the data put you in the failure group. And I didn't want to have to say that. But the reality was they came back and I said, Ron, it's not going to change. It is what it is. The great news was they're learnable, right? You can acquire these four things soon in your career. They were context, right? So this is the ability to read the environment around you. This is the ability to be curious and ask questions about how things should be done. This is a curious ability to read the context of your landscape of what's headed for your way that's disruptive technologically or socially or competitively. It's reading the tea leaves around you. It's asking yourself, why are things the way they are here? Not just imposing your ideas or assuming that people need what you have. It's realizing that you have to adapt as much to the environment as you have to change in the environment to fit your plan. Breadth. So this is the ability to see the broader picture of the organization, right? So it's not just growing up in your silo in marketing and seeing the world through the lens of consumers, or growing up through finance and seeing the world economically. This is now seeing how all the pieces fit together. Understanding that at the seams of a community or organization, that's where value gets created, and learning how to stitch those seams and build bridges across them to create cohesion. Organizations and communities are naturally fragmenting, they pull apart. Our job as a leader is to create cohesion and pull them together. And that's what breadth was. Choice. This is the decision-making process, right? So these leaders, most of the leaders that failed said yes too often. They were so afraid of disappointing people that they doled out way too many yeses. And these leaders were able to say no. They were able to narrow the focus of the organizations to a few priorities and forego even great ideas so that the ideas they've already committed to can prevail, rather than diluting the focus of the organization, spreading the resources too thin, and hearing the classic cries of, our priorities are changing every day. Sticking to a course you commit to. And the last one, not surprisingly, was connection. These are the people who everybody wanted to work for, right? They have phenomenal relationships with direct reports, with peers, with bosses. They're the ones that everybody regards and trusts. But the critical commitment to their relationships wasn't, how do they build a network of people they can get stuff from? But they intentionally prioritized the people they could help succeed. They went out of their way to find people whose success and agenda they could contribute to. And they were focused on that, not on what they could get. And people knew that to be in their presence, to be on their teams, to be mentored by them or led by them meant you would get better. And that's the reputation that we developed. So you can see any one of those, hard to build. Breadth, context, choice, connection, doing all four of them feels like a tall order. But if you start soon enough, you know, when you get the biggest job you're aspiring to get, you're going to be ready.
So this idea of context, breadth, choice, connection, and I know we barely scratched the surface. How can we get our hands on more of the materials that your book or maybe some of the articles, where point us in the direction to find you?
Yeah. So first place, come visit us at our website, Navalant, NAVALANT.com. We've got lots of fun things there. There's a quarterly magazine we'd love to give you for free on our insights on teams and leadership and organizations and community building. There's a, if you go to navalet.com/transformation, we have a free ebook for you on leading transformation. So you can download that and see our blueprint for how it is we construct transformational journeys. If you go to HBR, I've got a bunch of articles there. There's one called The 10-Year Study Reveals What Great Executives Know and Do. And that's the article that summarizes this research. There's also a video, a whiteboard session at HBR that I do on these four attributes. You can watch that there as well. Books on Amazon. I'd love to connect with you guys on Twitter at Ron Carucci and on LinkedIn. So come find me there as well.
And folks, we're going to drop all of this stuff in the show notes so that you can pour over everything that Ron is so freely giving to not just the listeners of this podcast, but anyone who wants to learn more about life and leadership. I want to ask you this last question as we wrap up our time together. One of the key questions that you suggest that leaders need to ask over and over and over again to their teams and to the people around them is, what can I do to improve? Mm-hmm. Why is it so important to ask that question?
You know, we're just, as leaders, as human beings, we're bad. We're bad observers of our own reality. We don't see the context around us. We don't see us in situ. We think that our intentions are good so that they match our impact, and they don't. I think it's interesting that we're designed as human beings to not be able to see our own face, right? Our eyes face out. Mm-hmm. We need other eyes on us, and you should want that. You should want to know how other people are experiencing you. You should want to know how it is your leadership, your influence, your ideas are being metabolized, and to know that there are always going to be gaps in your intention and your impact. And you should absolutely want that. Everybody's talking about them. You should want to know what they are. The question I ask my sometimes a little bit feedback averse leaders are, and usually the millennials, this generation, they're feedback starved. You can tell them anything. They take hard feedback better than anybody. It's the older folks that are a little bit thin skinned, but I say, look, imagine leaving a dinner party, fairly fancy one, with your significant other. Leave a little early, get in the car, and he or she turns to you and says, honey, you've got a big thing hanging off the end of your nose. It's been there all night. Get it off. And you're sitting there going, what? You're telling me now? Well, every one of us has things hanging off of behavior we can't see. And everybody else is talking about them. You should just want to be in on the conversation. And to assume that they're not there, to assume that no news is good news, is just dangerous. It's just a dangerous assumption as a leader.
Ron, thanks so much. It's been an incredible conversation today. I know I am richer for it, and I know the listeners are richer for it. We appreciate all your insights, and we wish you all the best as you go help leaders make the change that they're called to make.
Pierre, it was a pleasure. Best of luck to you and your good work on the world. I hope that your voice continues to be amplified and that you continue to have make the mark you want to make.
Wow. I mean, all I can say is wow. Incredible conversation with Ron Carucci. And I hope you got a lot out of it. Man, you're going to have to replay it a couple of times to really, really extract all of the good stuff that Ron packed into our conversation. Listen, I want to invite you one more time. If you haven't done so already, head over to iTunes, leave me a 5-star review and some comments. How is this podcast making a difference in your life? And pass this thing on, like it, share it, whatever you see it on social media, maybe on my blog, prcquinn.com. Let people know. Don't keep all the good stuff to yourself, because we're on a mission, not just for you and me, but we're on a mission to help as many people as we can live, learn, and lead with confidence. Hey, that's all I got for this episode of the Leading Wild Green podcast. And until next time, take care and God bless.